I mean, January 15th, 1998, we were in the offices of Albert Kaufman, the acting director, or perhaps he is the director, we'll ask him, of the Mexican Legal Defense Fund in San Antonio, Texas. And this is his office. Kids. And he'll be here shortly. This is on the eve of the filing against the United States Army and Corps of Engineers for militarization of the border. So the office is in a tizzy, and he's been somewhat detained. So it'll be a quick, fast interview. We're on. I already said all the intro. This is Albert Kaufman. Why do you do this?
What?
Be a lawyer and run MALDEF in San Antonio?
Well, it's sort of been a life's work. I mean, I grew up in the 60s. Anti-war movement, civil rights movement, all that as a background. Went to law school so I could somehow do civil rights work, and was lucky to get a job with MALDEF in 74. And I just got so interested, and I decided to stick with it. So I've been with it for 20, I guess, Mexican-American civil rights issues. 23 years, but civil rights issues for about 30 years now.
Long history.
Not compared to some people, but
how much longer are you going to do this?
I'll probably do this the rest of my life, because actually you get to a point where that's all you can do.
Excellent.
I don't, I'm not saying I would be against going and doing some other sort of law and maybe a little bit less pressure and maybe a little bit more money, but I mean, I enjoy this. And the fact is that after a while, that's all you really know how to do. I mean, I don't know whether I could actually go be a lawyer and do contracts and divorces and stuff. I'd be competing with people right out of law school no more than I do.
There's been some drastic changes here at this office. You are not only the litigator, you're also the administrator?
Well, but that's the way this office is run. The general, what they call the regional council, has always been involved in litigation too in this office. You know, you had Joaquin Avila was the regional counsel, and Jose Garza was the regional counsel, and Norma Cantu was the regional counsel, and you know, basically everybody has done both the administration and the and litigation.
So you're number four?
You know, I think there's been a few others. At one time Eddie Dar was head of this office back in the early 70s. I think Josiana Gutierrez, I think, worked with us at one time, and then back to paralegal. There was Eddie Dodd, there was Jim Heidelberg, George Corbel, Joaquin Avila, Jose Garza, Norma Cantu, Luis Wilmot, and I.
Is it true that Henry B. Gonzalez had MALDEF run out of town?
Well, that's the rumor. I wasn't around at the time, but I understand he had a lot to do with it, and apparently it was because he thought the organization was too political and was sort of against the Democratic Party, and thought it was trying to split the Democratic Party. And he began to get very curious about our activities. And my understanding is that he made complaints to committees in Congress and to the IRS about our tax-exempt status. And I think the board decided it might be better to be in a little bit better area. And so they moved to San Francisco. Yep. I think another reason for it was, honestly, there are more foundations with money on the West Coast than there are in Texas. And so much of our budget then and still does come from foundations, that it didn't hurt to be closer to the foundations. And I mean, MALDEF couldn't be in New York or Washington, which is real centers of foundations. So I mean, I think California made some sense. But I do think it was the pressure to move us out, as well as as a decision to move somewhere else for funding.
When was that?
I'm not sure the exact year, but I think it was something like 71 or 72 is when the office moved. I know that MALDEF was started here in San Antonio. The head of it was here in San Antonio. And when Vilma Martinez became the head of it, I think that was about the time we moved out to San Francisco. Right about the time Mario Oblero left and Vilma came in. Roughly during the 72 period, but I'm not sure whether it's 71, 73, 72. When I got here in 74, it was already done. The central office was in San Francisco for sure. Vilma had been selected head of the organization in 73, Vilma Martinez. And I know that was all done by 73. So the move was completed by then. I just don't know exactly what year it is. I can find out.
The San Antonio office, I guess this is about the fourth move, you know, this is the fourth address that I know, I think.
Oh yeah, San Antonio office has moved a few times, but you know, considering it's been here for going on 30 years, it's been fairly stable. And Maldiv has had a presence within four blocks of this office its entire existence. I mean, it started down, four blocks down from here in the International Building, which is four blocks down in Houston. Then it moved to the Petroleum Commerce Building. We were there for 17 years. I got there in 74, that's where I went, and we closed out of there, I think, in 89, we left there. Then moved to a Commerce Bank Building over on Commerce Street, and then over to here. So it's been all within a few blocks of the same downtown area the entire existence of Maldiv, which is going on 30 years this year.
Do you know why Maldiv doesn't buy its own building or collaborate with other similar groups?
Well, now, you know,
have Maldiv, a big additional building?
Well, in San Antonio, I don't know. Maldiv does have its own building in Los Angeles, and a 11-story building. And it's been, you know, a lot of financial commitment to that, because of course that's where the headquarters is. And we have bought a building, which by the way, was the site of the Los Angeles Stock Exchange back in the 20s and 30s, and where William French Smith, one of the US Attorney Generals, had his law offices. And that's our building, so we've got that. Why we haven't bought a building here, I don't know. Other than, you know, that's a real mixed blessing, having your own building. It's nice to have your own building. You think you're going to get free rent, but all the hassles that come with it. I think we're doing okay. The rents in San Antonio are very reasonable. I mean, downtown rent here is much more reasonable than it would be out on the Loop, or probably get about as cheaply as we would if we had our own building. So I think.
What is that? How much you'll pay for this floor?
I think it's around $2,000 a month. It's about $1 a square foot or something, which is real cheap rent for a big city and very nice space.
Has anyone written the history of Maldiv?
There have been a lot of attempts at parts of that. There was a very good report on our 25th anniversary, which I need to share with you, to looking at the first 25 years, a nice pamphlet put out, not a true history. Our archives are at Stanford University Library, and there's a book of about 100 pages doing nothing but listing the files of Maldiv that are in the area. There was a film, one large corporation said they were doing a film on the history of Maldiv, but I don't think I've ever seen it. But beyond that, I don't think there is a good history of Maldiv. It's certainly, you know, Maldiv's been written about in articles that talk about the development of nonprofits and been articles on it, but nobody's written a book on it. There probably should be, but I don't think there is.
What is the content of those archives that you described?
Well, those archives have all of the original files of Maldiv that are closed cases and are not considered confidential documents. There are memos setting up board meetings. There are memos creating the Chicana Rights Project. There are files of mine, Al Kaufman's, when he was here from 74 to 77 at Maldiv. There's some Mario Blato's work. There are files from all the different Maldiv offices, basically files that we closed, you know, old files we just cannot keep in a building like this, and that did not have any client confidences in them, are all on, indeed, display and available at the Stanford Library and are cataloged by the Stanford University staff.
And the content of this long interview that you gave of oral history nature like this at St. Mary's, is it a tape? Is it transcribed?
It's a tape. I don't think it's transcribed. It's by Professor Liao. Ray Liao is his name. I remember I talked to you and I couldn't remember his name. It's Ray Liao, and he's in the Department of Political Science. And it was just about an hour tape of just about our education work, history of the education cases and what the law is in the area.
Up to what time?
Well, you know, we did the tape about 5 years ago, and I think it was up to that date. And I think it was mainly spending time on the Edgewood case, on some of the desegregation cases, and I think maybe a little bit about the higher education case, Lulek versus Richards.
Yes. Well, I'll try to skip that area, and unless you think it's important to bring it in, please do so, because I'll try to get a copy of that tape.
Sure.
And just augment this with that so we
sure.
can save time
sure.
here. Why don't you tell us a little biography? I mean, who is Al Kaufman?
Okay. Well, you know, Al Kaufman's a kid who grew up in a pretty middle-class existence down in Galveston, Texas. Came from an old Jewish family that landed here in 1870 and 1880. And was part of, there was a very small Jewish population in Galveston, and they were part of that population, been there a long time. I had a great uncle who was mayor of Galveston. I had a great uncle who graduated from UT Law School in 1916. My grandmother was in the choir at the St. Mary's Catholic Church and at the Jewish Temple, which she belonged to. You know, pretty small but sort of ecumenical existence around in Galveston, actually. And then I just went to college in 1965, and I mean, I got involved in civil rights issues, and, you know, I was, of course, there during the anti-war movement. And I got very interested in that and decided that's what I want to do with my life. And when I was in college, I did some work with Upward Bound and starting projects for African-American businesses starting in the ghettos in Boston. And then I went to Vista and worked in rural Oregon for a year, putting together nonprofit businesses for poor population in that area.
What part of Oregon?
In Medford, Oregon. I worked in Medford and Rogue River and Ashland, Oregon. And then I taught school in Mississippi in 1970 in a school that was just integrated for the first time. I was just real interested in seeing what was going on in the South, so I taught school for a year in Lake, Mississippi. Then I decided after all that being an organizer or being a teacher was probably not a very quick way to make many changes to do the sort of work I wanted to do, so I thought about law school. So I applied to UT Law School and entered in 1971, and then I kept doing the same sort of work. We started prep sessions for the LSAT, trying to get minority students interested in law schools. You know, I was there at the worst in the history of UT Law School since Sweat B. Painter. I mean, there was no minorities in my class. 500, five Mexican-Americans, one black, UT Law School.
All males?
No, I think there was one female out of all of them, but basically all men. At the time, the law school was 90% male. So the law school was basically 90% Anglo male.
Any salient or memorable moments or times or experiences or episodes in your early childhood or high school or college or during the work in Oregon or Mississippi?
I somehow got into wanting to do work in the civil rights area. It just always seemed interesting to me, something I wanted to do. I'm not sure exactly why. I mean, certainly no religious calling. It just seemed interesting and something I wanted to do. And as I said, seeing all the civil rights marches, I mean, I grew up watching the Selma March on TV and hearing about it. And when I was in college, there were the anti-war movements and Martin Luther King was assassinated and all that was going on. I decided that there would need to be some good work done there and I'd like to do it. So that's always what I wanted to do.
Well, who are your parents? Their names, their grandparents,
yeah,
their wives,
sure,
children, whatever?
Sure. My father was Bernard Kaufman and born in Galveston. My grandmother was born in Galveston in 1885. My father grew in a family that had a small furniture store. They were small business people in Galveston. My mother's grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Her mother was in one of the covered wagons, went out there and took land in Oklahoma back in the rush, and grew up in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and moved to Tulsa. And her father was from Fort Worth, mother from Tulsa, and she grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, an only child. They had a family that had grocery stores. My grandfather had one grocery store in 1918 and had 75 grocery stores in 1929 and sold them all out for $750,000 in 1929 and invested it all in second mortgages and went from $750,000 to $10,000 total assets in one day at the time of the stock market crash. Second mortgages, needless to say, were the first things to go. So he went back and he ran one single grocery store for the rest of his life. But so that's the way she grew up.
What was her name?
Celia Marie.
Is her name? Is she still alive?
No, they're both passed away. My father was Bernard, my mother was Celia Marie. And they both grew up in Jewish families, pretty much Reformed Jewish families. They met because they had a common second cousin who got them together at a party. My mother was a dancer. Wonderful dancer. My mother had very dark coloring, very dark skin, green eyes, dark hair, and she danced as a Latin American dancer in New York City in 1938 and 39, would do club bits as a Latin American dancer at the age of 19. Single woman on her own in New York City, that was quite risque at the time. And then her parents got upset about it and they sent her out on tour to find herself a good eligible Jewish man. She found my father and they got married. And that was it.
Brothers and sisters?
Brothers and sisters. A sister who's a nurse and has three kids. She's in Washington, D.C. I have a brother who's a statistician for the Houston School District, all but a dissertation for a PhD in statistics. I have a nephew who's 30 years old and a doctor who went from being a very Reformed Jew to conservative Jew to extremely Orthodox Jew. has red hair, green eyes, big red beard, hat, coat, the whole thing.
So now, that's my explain that to me. What's a Reformed Jew?
Sure.
The other kind of Jew. I know what the Orthodox is.
Oh, well, there's Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox. And of course, there are variations within each. Basically, the Reformed use little or no Hebrew in the ceremonies, do not wear yarmulkes, observe all the holidays, but not quite as intensely. They have mainly English in their services. Of course, men and women sit together, that sort of thing.
Sounds like good Catholics.
Actually, they're very Orthodox Jews who go into a Reformed congregation. In fact, my sister's mother-in-law was very conservative, said when she went into our congregation, she felt like she might as well have been in an Episcopal church, because there was so little Hebrew and so little relation. You know, no yarmulkes, no nothing.
And
so
conservative
sort of in the middle. They use more Hebrew. They usually wear the skull cap, the yarmulke they call it, or the kippah is another name for it. They follow ceremonies, as I said, more Hebrew services, longer religious services. In terms of the actual dogma of the religions, I think the only real differences is that the Reform believe that there will someday be a messianic age. And there are many Orthodox Jews who truly believe that someday there will be a Messiah. They obviously do not believe that Jesus was a Messiah, but that someday there will be a Messiah. But the Orthodox Jews, for instance, my nephew goes to a synagogue where men sit completely separately from women. Every part of their social and personal lives is controlled by studying the Talmud. He studies the Talmud for 8 hours a day every Saturday, complete kosher existence. And my family was basically, I grew up around Episcopalians and Catholics and Methodists. I mean, that was my world. So it's just Jewish background is a rich, can be a very rich experience. And my kids now, I've got two kids. My wife is a Mexican-American, was born in Mexico and grew up in the Valley. And so my kids are sort of part Mexican and part Jewish, and a real capirotada that they are.
What are their names?
Bernard, Miguel, and Marcos Nathan. And Bernard Miguel is 5, and Marcos Nathan's 3.
And the wife?
My wife is Olga, Maria Olga Garza Kaufman. I met her here in San Antonio. We were both on the board of the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center here, and that's where we met.
Where is she from in Mexico?
She was born in Tamaulipas, a little town called Valle Hermoso, which is not too far from Matamoros. And both her mother and father had some land there they got during the 1930s, during the land redistribution. And they had land next to each other and grew up around each other. Her mother and father both from the same small town. She was born in Mexico, and then the family came across when she was 6 months old. Yeah. Her mother had an interesting experience, by the way. Her mother was actually born in the United States, and when she was 4 or 5 years old in the 1930s, she was deported by the United States. They had a lot of repatriations, they called them. And so that's her mother's background. So she was born in Harlingen. Her family's from Mexico, born in Harlingen, and was sent back with her family to Mexico.
What was her name?
Her name was Reina. We call her Maria de Reyes Ortiz Garza.
Let's call her Reina.
I call her Reina, sure.
Yeah, she's still alive?
She's still alive. She's 65 and still works as a custodian in a school district down in the Valley, Rio Hondo ISD, and still works 40 hours a week doing physical labor. She's 65.
So what did you learn in Mississippi when you went out there to find out what that was all about?
You know, I learned some differences between urban and rural racism, between urban and rural race relations. Because I'd worked in Boston when I was in college, trying to work in the ghettos and work with poor kids in that area. And basically the poor kids, the black kids, didn't really know the white kids because they went to separate schools, of course. Or they just grew up in completely different socioeconomic worlds. In the South, the rural South where I worked, everybody knew each other. Now they knew each other because the black kids' parents worked for the white kids' parents. But the kids grew up around each other. They grew up on land right next to each other. Now, on the other hand, they were more interested in keeping the races separate, but they knew each other better. So it was very interesting because the black families and white families, everybody knew everybody. The black families and white families lived around each other for generations. And in Mississippi, a very stagnant economy. There wasn't a lot of movement in or out of this little city where I worked in Lake. But of course, there was complete racism. And I also got to see what it's like when, you know, I was in the school the first time I was ever integrated, 1970. I mean, this is 16 years after Brown v. Board of Education. In 1969, in that school district, they had complete segregation. The K through 12 black school, K through 12 white school. Black kids lived across the street from the white school were bused 5 miles to black school. I mean, complete, absolute segregation. Until finally, the Fifth Circuit said they were going to close them down and cut off their funds unless they integrated. So they did, overnight. So it was a shocking thing. A lot of interesting, you know, when you mix two races like that have never gone to school together and so afraid of each other and yet sort of knew each other, families, just a lot of interesting sociology and political science. I was a 22-year-old white kid with long red hair, and I'd been in Oregon as a visitor. I had Oregon plates on my car, so it's just a real strange thing. Where I worked in Mississippi was 40 miles from Philadelphia, Mississippi, you know, where the civil rights workers were killed. And that was 6 years before. It was all fresh in people's minds. So it was a pretty hot time, pretty active KKK group there at the time.
Were you afraid?
Yeah, I was afraid.
All the time?
A lot of the time. I actually bought a little 22 pistol, only gun I've ever had in my life. Just because I didn't want to look out and see white sheets and flames without having sun protection. Of course, they would have shotguns, I'm sure, so it would have been good. It was scary for me. Yeah. But I just, you know, kept pretty quiet.
So when did you become a lawyer?
Became a lawyer 71, went to law school, 71 to 74. I said after years of visiting Oregon and a year as a school teacher, I just decided maybe law a little bit, maybe safer and maybe a better way to do this work. So I went to UT Law School for 3 years. So I actually graduated from law school in 74 and got my bar results in October 74, and the next day I started law day.
Did you apply?
I had applied 3 months before, but they said, of course, they wouldn't decide until the bar results came out.
Had you ever worked with or associated with Mexican Americans?
Well, associated with, yes, and worked with, but never in a way I did at Malden. I mean, I grew up in Galveston, and I mean, there were Mexican Americans in my class. I was the campaign manager for a guy named Lupe Salinas, who later on became a
Houston.
He became a state district court judge, was almost a federal court judge. I was his campaign manager, ran for vice president of student council.
In Galveston. I didn't realize he was from Galveston.
He's from Galveston. Joe Hernandez, the state rep, is from Galveston.
The one here.
Gonzalo Barrientos, I think his family, part of his family, is from Galveston. So there was a population there. But it was just in school, and it was fairly well segregated. I mean, we had our class, I think, had one Mexican American in it. That was Inez Hernandez, who we called Inez Hernandez. No doubt about it. But never worked with the next. When I was in law school, as I said, I worked on this project to bring minorities into the law school. And there was a Chicano Law Student Association, those were some good friends of mine. A guy named Luis Moreno became a county court of law judge in the Valley, now practices here, was there. A guy named Luis de la Garza, who was the general counsel of Valero Oil over here, was in law school with me. So. But not too many. There were not too many.
Did you have any involvement with the Raza Unida Party in the early 70s?
Not until I got to Malden. I got to Malden in 74, we represented the Raza Unida Party. I worked real closely with Rosy Castro, with Ernesto Calderon. I met Ramsey once, but just once. A guy named Lupe Youngblood, I mean, some of the officers of the Raza Unida Party. But Malden, of course, had worked with the Raza Unida Party a lot. George Corbel was the lawyer done voting. He worked very closely with the Raza Unida Party. One of our cases was, when the Voting Rights Act first applied to Texas was 1975. And basically it says that there's a change in voting procedures, it has to be pre-cleared by the Justice Department. In 1973 legislature, they changed the rules regarding financing and party primaries. Until then, if any political party got over 5% of the vote, the next year their political primaries were paid for by the state. So basically meant that the Republican and Democratic parties were paid for their primaries. When the Raza Unida Party got more than 5%, the next session they changed it to 20%. And Ramsey Muniz had gotten 5%, I think, running against Dolph Briscoe, and made Dolph Briscoe the first minority elected governor in the state of Texas, as far as I know. So Texas changed the laws. So we represented the Raza Unida Party in a case called Raza Unida Party versus White, and we stopped that election law, went back to 5%. So that's when I got to meet a lot of the Razanita people. And not long after that, I guess the Razanita Party really wasn't very strong after about 75, 76.
Do you remember the first case you handled as a brand new lawyer?
There were two or three that were dropped on my lap sort of at the same time. One of them was the San Antonio single-member district case. At the time, San Antonio was elected from multi-member districts for city council. I worked on the sort of third round of the White v. Register case, and that's the one that broke up the multi-member districts for electing state representatives into single-member districts. And Malda had represented Mexican-Americans in the case and won for Bexar County. And then on the second round, one for the other counties where there are Mexican-Americans, basically for the Valley, for El Paso, for Lubbock. And we represented them. So I was involved in drawing some of those districts, especially in Corpus Christi, and that follow-up on that, and worked a little bit in the legislature. And then another case was against Del Rio, San Felipe Del Rio, because they had a country club on the San Felipe Creek that didn't let any Mexican-Americans in. So we represent a guy named Turullos, who's a doctor here in San Antonio now, who basically sued because the city of Del Rio rented this prime land in Del Rio on the San Felipe Creek to this private discriminatory country club for $1 a year. So, I mean, that case was done before I got here, but I sort of did the sort of follow-up on that.
What was the outcome of that?
Eventually, they opened up and let more Mexican-Americans in to play golf, basically, and open it up. So that was the end of it. But we went to but Maldef won at the Court of Appeals, State Court of Appeals, saying that you couldn't do that and sending it back on remand because the district court had dismissed it. And eventually, they just opened up their doors. I don't know what's going on there. I think that country club still exists, but it no longer has an exclusionary policy on who can be in.
Which case has been the most exciting for you? Which case has been the most devastating for you or disappointing in terms of outcome?
The most exciting was the Edgewood v. Kirby case for me. That's the school finance case in Texas, just because it involved so many kids and had such a real impact on the education system. That's, I think, been the most exciting I've ever worked on in my life. I think there are two that tie for most disappointing. I guess the worst one was a case I did on testing against one of these standardized tests the state of Texas wanted to use to control entry into schools of education. And it had a real negative effect on Mexican-Americans and blacks. And I won at the district court, and the Fifth Circuit went against us. And that was really devastating. And the other one is my higher ed case, Lulac versus Richards, where we won a very good judgment from the district court. We got a hell of a lot of money from the Texas legislature. And then the Texas Supreme Court went against us 9-0. Finding that the system of financing higher education didn't discriminate against Mexican Americans. So.
Only. It said discriminate against all. Everybody.
Yeah, that's right. It basically said discriminate maybe against the whole border, but not against Mexican Americans per se, because there are a lot of Mexican Americans in Houston and Dallas.
I remember some details, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't the jury, wasn't the jury judgment substituted by the judge?
Part of it. The jury found for us on some issues and against us on some issues. But the judge gave us a directed verdict on the issue where jury went against us. And they gave us a judgment where the jury went for us. The jury found that the system was inefficient and had the and wasted money, and that it that the state had impeded the efforts to form a Mexican-American law school in effect down on the border. The jury found for us on those. The jury found against us on intentional discrimination. They found that the individual members of the Boards of Regents and Governor Richards did not intentionally discriminate against Mexican-Americans. I mean, we had objected to that jury instruction. We don't think it was a good question. It wasn't a relevant question, but they found against us on the question that you were asked on that issue.
Who was the trial judge?
Benjamin Uresti, who's from Brownsville. And he gave us a judgment. He gave us a directed verdict on those issues and gave us a judgment, I guess a judgment NOV, on all of our different causes of action. Discrimination case, on the efficiency case, also.
But when did the law change, and was Malda responsible for that? At some time, the prevailing point of law was that it did not apply to higher ed, the efficiency clause.
Oh no, that's what the Supreme Court found. They found the efficiency clause does not apply.
Oh, so that part was reversed.
That part was reversed. Yeah.
Is that still the standard?
Yeah, that's still the law. I mean, the Supreme Court said that the efficiency clause in the Texas Constitution—that's the one we won the school finance case, the public school finance case on. did not apply to higher ed. And then it found on the discrimination case, certainly it does apply, but that we hadn't proved it. Because although there were a lot of Mexican Americans on the border, there were a lot outside the border. So we couldn't really show that the system was intentionally designed to discriminate against the Mexican Americans of the state, because there were Mexican Americans in Houston and Dallas who were benefited by the system. So that's what the Supreme Court found. So one part they found against us on the law, and the other part they sort of found against us on the facts.
Well, the school finance cases, that's gone on for like 20 some odd years. Is litigation the answer in that area?
Well, I think litigation was the answer in that area. I certainly do. You know, it's gone on for that long, but there was 10 years when nothing happened. I mean, there was the San Antonio ISD versus Rodriguez case in the U.S. Supreme Court was sort of in litigation from 69 to 73, and then that was over. We filed our case in 84 in state court, and I think there's no doubt that we made a tremendous change in that system to improve it. So I don't think litigation alone does it. I mean, although I do litigation, that's my business, I think it alone doesn't do it. I mean, you need to combine the litigation with community work, community organizing around the issues, legislative advocacy around the issues, all that has to be done together. I mean, I never believe that just one judge, you know, herself or himself can change the whole system, or one lawyer. But I think sometimes you have to break up the system, which is what we did in Edgewood.
One of the criticisms of MALDEF is that in a lot of these said cases, they walked away at the remedy stage. And one of the examples people use is agreement to the singleton ratio that capped resource allocation at 20% back when for Mexican Americans. Of course, the population has always been growing. So now Mexican Americans have no standing in Houston, they have no standing in other places.
Well, I think part of that criticism is fair, but not quite for those reasons. I think that MALDEF was involved in many desegregation cases all around the country, and indeed was sort of the only organization doing those for Mexican Americans, and probably got stretched out too thin. I mean, at one time we were involved in desegregation cases in Uvalde, El Rio, New Braunfels, Odessa, Dallas, Houston, El Paso, Tucson, God knows how many other districts as well. So I think we did a good job.
Dallas, Fort Worth?
Yeah, basically all those, one way or another. I'm not sure, Dallas I know we were involved, I'm not sure about Fort Worth. And those we weren't involved in, we probably should have been. So I think we were there representing our population when we got the final orders putting on the population. After that, I don't think we've done a real good job following up, going back every year and seeing what is going on wrong and trying to bring more actions. I don't think we've done that nearly well. I think some of that responsibility is shared by the community groups who weren't coming back to us and saying, you know, look, we still need to do more in this district. But part of that was our fault. So I think that some of that criticism is fair. As far as the singleton ratios, I'm not sure what you mean by that, because that was like Fifth Circuit law, and singleton ratios are really about allocation of employees, of teachers. The singleton ratio is that, you know, if you have 20% Mexican American teachers in the district, that you have to have around 20% in each school. And the reason was that that was one way they could keep a school from being identified as an all-black school or all-Mexican school. Now, I do think there's some conflicts there with bilingual programs. At the time, that's caused a problem. But singleton has never meant that you couldn't have more than 20% Mexican American teachers. I mean, the ratio just said, of all the teachers you have in the district, you have to distribute them pretty equally among the schools. But it never was meant as a cap. I mean, we never agreed to it, and the law was never that you could use it as a cap. If any district ever did that, they certainly violated the singleton order, no doubt about that.
Houston now, and Dallas.
I think Houston did that.
And even to this day.
I think so.
Sanders has modified that 20% cap to like 34 or something. But that's still below the percent of Mexican American students that are in the school district. It's about 49, blacks are like 47, whites are way, way down now, and you still have majority white teaching staff and under the 34% Mexican American.
I no doubt that's right. I will say that, you know, we advocated for, but we have definitely lost on the issue, and everybody has. There's no way the court you're going to get a court to say that because you have 50% Mexican-American students, you need to have 50% Mexican-American teachers. It's based on labor market. And the state of Texas has 14% Mexican-American teachers. And there's just no way that we could ever get a judge to say that a district has to have 50% Mexican-American teachers. Just no way. I mean, the law is all against us. Supreme Court law, district court law, and me. Now, if at any time the Dallas district or any other district said, you know, we don't need to hire more Mexican-American teachers, then they are violating Singleton and violating Title VII, for sure. And, you know, somebody should go after them, either us or somebody.
Well, they don't say that. They say they can't find any.
Well, sure, that's what they say. And, I mean, they're not, they're out there. They should find them. On the other hand, as I said, legally, it's a real hard case right now because you don't even have a prima facie case on some of those. Because the districts, I mean, we looked at some recently, I'm not going to mention any names, districts that have 16% Mexican-American teachers should have a lot more, but the state only has 14%. And unless you can really time down to particular practices they've done, it's real hard.
You think a case can be made for bilingual ed in that almost every school district asks for an exemption? Almost every school district that I know of has underserved children that they have no instruction. Isn't that not only a statutory violation, but also a violation under 14th equal protection?
Well, I mean, we can argue that. I'm saying the law's not going to be real good on it because, you know, we can go after that as hard as we want, and we should. You know, we have the old bilingual education case that Waldorf has done and won. But that I think we have
one. Which one was that?
U.S. v. Texas bilingual was a judgment by Judge Justice in 1981, and it forced the legislature to come up with the present bilingual education bill. And that probably does need to be enforced further. But on the issue of Mexican-American teachers, and I've talked to very strong bilingual advocates all around the country, it's very difficult to do anything on the issue of the lack of availability of bilingual teachers because they're just not there. Now, the state's partially responsible for that, but it's going to be awfully difficult to get a court to decide that the state hasn't done enough to get more bilingual teachers. You know, because to tie that to the state is very, very difficult. That's all I'm telling you.
You know, then it could be argued that the universities and colleges just don't even have the programs in the colleges of education. They don't create the bilingual department.
We can of course argue that, and of course their response always is they relate to demand. If they have 500 people, Mexican Americans, who come in and want to take bilingual education courses, they'll offer them. But I mean, you get into the chicken and the egg arguments. And we did that in our higher ed case. We ran into a lot of that. They said, well, there's no programs because there's no demand. And we said, well, there's no demand because there's no programs. And I think you can win on that issue some. We did it before the district court in the higher ed case, where I think we convinced the judge, and I think convinced any person who looks at it fairly, and again, proof of the pudding's in the eating. It's worked. They put programs there, they have more students. I mean, the enrollments in Brownsville and Laredo have just skyrocketed, because all of a sudden they had more programs. Laredo had about 900 students in higher ed. Now they have 3,000 or 4,000 just in a few years. Brownsville is about a few hundred, and now they're up to several thousand. You know, there are examples all over where if you put the programs there, you get the kids. So I mean, I agree with you on the argument. I'm just saying to get a court to force, you know, to force the state to say you must, you know, to hold them in contempt eventually for not having enough bilingual education programs, unless we can show there are a hell of a lot of kids coming out and we're interested in it, it's real hard. Maybe it's worth doing, but real hard case.
Do higher ed students have a right to a curriculum? Secondary kids have a right to a curriculum, say Chicano studies?
I'd like to think that they do, but I don't think we're finding any courts that agree with us on that. I mean, ultimately, the law says that, you know, like states don't even have to have an education system if they don't want. I mean, under the federal constitution, they don't have to. Well, it's a state constitutional thing. And under the state constitution, I don't think we're going to get courts to order them to do that. I think that's going to have to be a political thing. I think it should be done, should be argued, that you should have studies that Mexican-American students all around should be able to study their culture and history. I think it's very important for them. To get courts to order it is going to be very hard. I think if you can get a higher ed, if you can do it more broadly, as we tried to do in the LULAC case, we get a broad judgment saying that there's not service to the community. And as part of that, say that you have to have curriculum sort of not only aim, but specifically designed to meet the needs of a community, that's probably the way to do it. But I don't think separating it out, saying you have a, the students have a constitutional or even statutory right to have certain types of curriculum, I just don't think it's gonna work legally. I'm not against the theory, it's a great theory, but I just don't think it's gonna work as I see the way the courts are going right now.
Before we leave this area of education, is there something here that you wanna mention? Because I'm gonna try to get that on the tape.
Sure.
I've only asked a few things that are contemporary.
Sure.
I only have one other on education, which is this English-only movement. Do you think that that will bump and preempt the statutory mandate for bilingual ed? Or what are the consequences of this English-only either amendment
I don't think it will.
Legislation?
No, I don't think it will. I think that there certainly are some people who would like it to. And of course, we're going to follow what happens in California very closely. Some people feel it's definitely going to pass what they call the UNS Amendment, which is going to...
UNS?
UNZ. There's a man named UNZ who's apparently the major proponent of the California proposition, which I think many people expect to be on the ballot this summer, which basically prohibit any sort of dual language program in the public schools. I think it's a very bad idea, and hopefully that can, I think that can be litigated for sure, because I think that the Supreme Court said back in 1975, the name of the case was Lau versus Nickel, 1975 Supreme Court case, that U.S. Supreme Court case, that if you have students who don't understand the language used in the schools, they're not getting an education. You have to offer them some education. So I just think that ultimately that has to be done. So I think there will be a good challenge to that one. I think it was harder to go after 209, as I think the court showed, they just wouldn't go with that. 187 in California, we're still going to see, and that started still the litigation. In Texas, we don't have initiative and referendum. So I think that the legislature in the state, although I criticize them and jump on them and fight them all the time, I don't think that there's a real majority in the state legislature that truly wants to end bilingual programs in the state. I think that there is a sense in this state, believe it or not, wasn't this way 25 years ago, but I think there is now, that it's not in our best interest to end programs that look like they're helping Mexican-American students. And indeed, it's such an insult to Mexico, and such an insult to the Mexican nationals, as well as the country of Mexico, to basically say that knowing Spanish is of no use in Texas, that I just don't think they're gonna do it in Texas. I could be wrong. I mean, there are often things filed in the legislature, but they just haven't gone anywhere. I think to a great extent because of the political power of the Mexican-American caucus in the House and the Senate Hispanic caucus, basically they've just said that that's non-negotiable for them. They're gonna fight to the death against anything to prohibit, you know, an English-only bill or an anti-bilingual education bill. I just don't think it's gonna go anywhere. Could be wrong.
Let's switch over to employment law.
Sure.
But take the English-only concept. Do employees have a right to speak Spanish at work?
Well, you wonder what I think the law should be or what the law is. I think the law should be is that, yes, they should be able to speak Spanish at any time they want, unless the employer can show that it literally hampers or hurts their business. But any of these policies that just say that, you know, we want no Spanish on the job, but should never be enforced at all, I think they're against the law. Now, they should be against the law. What actually seems to be against the law is that an employer can set policies if they have any business interest. And if they have a business, which includes policy of only English on the job, if they can show it's related to a safety interest or even a customer interest, under the laws it's developing now, I think they're gonna get it. They can support an English-only policy. I don't think that should be the law, and I think there are gonna be some good cases. We've talked to some people, we've been involved in some cases, and we've looked at it very closely. It's just very, very hard to do right now. I mean, there's a bad Fifth Circuit case, I forgot the name on it, but a bad Ninth Circuit case. And I think it's insane that that's the way it is. I mean, as far as I know, there's been no case saying that if two people who speak Spanish want to go in the lunchroom when they're off work and speak Spanish to each other, and people don't allow that, I don't think any courts have enforced that. But they have enforced a policy saying that two Spanish-speaking employees cannot speak Spanish to each other when there's a person who doesn't speak Spanish as a customer on the other side of the counter. And I think that that's the courts are supporting that sort of policy. It's a sad thing, that's the way it is.
Has the situation with undocumented workers or workers with work permits and these raids gotten any better? Is it still dark ages where?
Still the dark age. We're getting a lot. In fact, we're getting more and more complaints about raids recently, about INS policies. And of course, you know, here in Texas along the border, the militarization of the border, bringing federal troops to try to enforce the immigration issues and as well as, you know, they say it's also for drug issues, but to a great extent it's immigration issues.
This takes a long time to transcribe. Are you liberally to discuss what you're going to do in this area of fighting the Border Patrol or anyone else on the militarization of the border?
Well, let me just say, I'll say this. We've been contacted and we're considering litigation against the Border Patrol and against the Army Corps of Engineers for the massive public works projects they're going to be doing right along the river to build new roads, to increase other roads, to clear underbrush, to build helicopter ports, to store diesel fuel. They're going to set up military bases along the American side of the border, and with a lot of environmental consequences that they have not considered. So we are considering taking action against that under the Environmental Acts. We certainly are very concerned about from the point of view of like the Ezequiel Hernandez situation out in West Texas. Goat herder got killed by Marines. I mean, I think any time you have military people who are out there with guns trying to patrol, and given the way the border works, where you have, you know, you have Mexicans and Mexican Americans who certainly are going to be treated alike and look alike from 100 yards. Not that it's right to shoot anybody, but you're going to end up with a lot of citizens, permanent residents, who are going to be accosted by these people, and a lot of people from both sides of the border are going to be killed. Because, I mean, they're trained to kill. That's their job. The INS, the Border Patrol, although I certainly have not been a defender of Border Patrol, I think are actually better trained on working with civilians in the Border Patrol business. I mean, some of them go crazy, and I've been involved in lawsuits against, you know, officers who just beat up people. But in general, their training is, you know, you're involved in civil enforcement, and, you know, you're not supposed to be pulling out your gun as soon as you see somebody and blowing people away. I mean, having the Army involved in that is just a terrible situation. That's what happened in West Texas. So we're very concerned about that because, you know, we represent the Hispanic community. Some people forget, I know you don't, you haven't forgotten, but many people forget that our families are very often are mixtures, you know, of citizens, permanent residents, and undocumented persons all living in the country. And I mean, almost every family you talk to has family along the border, even in central or north Texas, has a relative or a member or a close associate who is possibly, it could be considered undocumented. So, I mean, these are rich families. And so it does affect us all when you have policies that affect, allegedly just to talk about, quote, illegal aliens, but it affects all of our families and all of our population. And then, of course, we always get mistaken. I mean, you know, Luis Wilmot, my predecessor in this job, whose family's lived here for 100 years, got accosted on the bus by immigration agents because he happened to have a long hair and a mustache. I mean, so we're always affected by the implementation of these policies. You know, the employment, we got a lot of, you know, when Simpson Rodino first went in, we got a lot of allegations of employment discrimination. People would go in and, you know, if they looked like a Mexican-American, you know, who could speak English without an accent, they were fine. But if they either spoke only Spanish or spoke with a heavy accent, people were questioning as far as their immigration status. And I mean, it so affects all of our community. So we're working on that.
The higher ed issues, I just remembered, as you said, you don't forget. There have been many Chicano professors have been denied tenure and have had employment discrimination problems at higher institutions of learning. Has Mullet ever taken a case on behalf of a professor along those lines?
Yes, we did. We took one or two out of California back in the mid-70s. We represented sort of a class of Mexican-American professors during the development of a Texas plan for higher education. You know, we represent Mexican American professors as a class, saying that part of your desegregation plan has to be an increase in recruitment. As far as an individual tenure case or an individual firing case, I don't think we've taken any in a long time. The fact is, it's very difficult to do any individual employment case. We've done a few now and then. The major ones, you try to work on our class actions. And tenure cases, of course, are that much more difficult than other cases. But, I mean, I'm not saying we would never take one, but
Well, explain that policy so it is clear for the record that MALDEV does, quote, precedent-setting cases. And it tries to do class actions because resources would be used up immediately if you go after individual cases. But can you flesh this out? I mean, what's the criteria? How do you go about deciding the kind of cases you do take? And how? What's the caseload? And is there a budget allocated per case, money plus resource?
Teacher? Sure. A lot of questions, a lot of good ones. First, how we take a case is, I guess, based on a few factors. One is, you know, does it have an issue that we need to litigate? There are a lot of cases that are basically do not have new legal issues in them, and our general policy is not to do those because there are private attorneys who take those cases and who can do them and make some money in them and do them as well or better than we can do them. We try to concentrate on issues involving, on cases involving new issues that have not been litigated or where we need to develop the law further. Obviously, another criteria is number of people involved in the community. I mean, if it's fairly old law, but we're talking about, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 employees, then obviously that's a positive factor on taking a case. The chances of success are important too. I mean, if it's a case that there's almost no chance to win, and the only way we can take that is if the issue is just so essential that it has to be litigated. On the other hand, if it's a real easy case, you know, it's almost always a private attorney who's willing to take one of those. I mean, an employment case where you have a pretty clear case, you can usually find a private lawyer to take it because you can make some money off it. And then it's the resources we have available, mainly in terms of staff, but also funding. You know, these cases get very expensive. We do not charge fees, and we pick up the cost on our cases. So I mentioned the higher ed case to you. We did. We have so far gotten no fees in that case. We're still going to move for them, but we have so far gotten no fees.
And about how much did you spend on that?
We spent over $300,000 of money out of pocket. I'm not talking about attorneys,
staff time,
or overhead and offices. I'm talking about expert fees, travel fees, studies, depositions, out-of-pocket checks that we wrote and sent to people is over $300,000. And that's a big, big investment. And I filed this testing case recently in the state against the state high school exit test. And that's one where we just felt it had to be done. It affected, you know, 40,000 kids a year who are failing this test, Latino kids who are failing the test. And it just we just had to deal with these issues. But we'll probably, if we litigate that all the way, I mean, if it has to be tried and retried and deposed and they have the whole range of experts, we'll probably spend $100,000 to $200,000 on that case and spend about half of an attorney's time for 2 or 3 years. I mean, on Edgewood, I spent roughly half my time for 5 years on that case. So that's why, you know, we cannot take as many cases as a lot of people would like us to take. Because when we take these big ones, it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy.
I was looking at the dockets that you provided in terms of the cases that are in the litigation docket. And I realize that there's other cases that are not there. But it seems to be that, at least in the San Antonio office, there's been a decline in the number of cases. What's the reason for that?
Well, I think there's been some decline for a few reasons. First of all, we've gone through a stage where there are fewer attorneys. We went from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2, and now we're back up to 4. So, I mean, there was a decrease in attorneys because of people leaving and not being replaced right away. We've done a lot of long-term work on old cases that are not new cases, and I think we've got a lot of unfair criticism for not filing new cases when, you know, I was doing Edgewood 5, and that was not a new case, but it was more involved than a new case.
I ran across the first one was, I think, Tilly versus something in the...
Yeah, we were involved in the original Rodriguez case back in 1971, 169 or 71, we were involved in the first school finance case in federal court I told you about. But in Edgewood, I'm talking about the Edgewood cases, we filed one in 84, we amended it and filed again in 85. We won it, and then they came with a new plan. We started filing it again in 1990, won again. We filed again in 1991, won again. Filed again in 1993 and lost, and 95 lost. So we've been through, but we only have one case there, but we've done it five times. So I mean, there is a criticism, I think a valid one, about not as many new cases. Some of that is because of fewer attorneys, but some of that is because we've been doing a lot of work on old cases. And some of the cases we have, we worked on for 10 or 15 years.
Has the budget been diminished for the San Antonio office?
No, the budget stayed about the same through the years.
Well, that's diminishing.
I think it's diminished, yeah. I think it's diminished in terms of buying power. In terms of buying power, I think it has diminished some, yes. Well, but it's going back up again now. As I said, we were down to two attorneys at one time, and then three, and now four. So I think we're back up to about where we were.
Getting back to the policy of criteria now, police brutality cases, abuse of authority, those basically were individuals like the case in Pearsall, Modesto Rodriguez.
Yes.
What was the outcome of that?
He settled and got a fairly good settlement for that. We worked on that, but you know, that's a case where we worked for several years and got him a decent amount of money, not a great deal. That was a little bit different issue though, because it was police brutality, but it was directly related to his going out and trying to find witnesses to talk about the Voting Rights Act. I mean, it wasn't the classic case of someone walking down the street and, you know, getting hassled by the police and beaten up, or the case of someone in a bar who's an innocent bystander who tells the police, you know, don't beat that guy up, and then gets beat up and gets charged with resisting arrest. It wasn't that sort of case. It was one where he was literally out trying to find witnesses to talk to the Justice Department lawyers who were coming down. One of the reasons we took that case, I actually filed that case, did the original pleadings on that case in 1975, 76, and I think we finally got the judgment for it in something like 81 or 82. So those things take a long time. Before I got here, there was a case Muldep did on a Mexican-American who was shot in his home called the Lopez case that took one lawyer almost an entire year. It was lost. Now, I mean, you can't always win, you can't always lose cases. It's important to take them on. But it's just a weighing process of whether to spend that much time for one case versus for one person versus spending it on another school desegregation case or a class action Title VII case or a school finance case or a bilingual case against a big district. I mean, it's a weighing process. No way we can do all the cases we get. We get requests almost every day to do a new case. So it's a matter of picking and choosing. Sometimes you don't pick the right one, sometimes you don't take enough on. I mean, it's not a perfect organization, but I mean it's a legitimate weighing of resources.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe off the record, I'll ask you about a certain person. In 1976, I believe, about the time of the Modesto Rodriguez perhaps, Muldep took a very a vigorous advocacy role in protesting the violence and police abuse of Mexican Americans in the southwestern states.
Sure.
And even went with pictorials, exhibits, mm-hmm. at least 30 killings and 70 some odd incidents of gross brutality. Has Muldep kept that project going? Because it's worse now than then. Is there any documentation
I don't think we really have kept that project going. No, I think that's, we were more involved in that in the early 70s for sure. We were very involved in the case for Morales, a Mexican-American from Pearsall.
Hondo?
Yeah, Pearsall, yeah, that's right. Hondo, who was killed in Castroville, shot by Sheriff Hayes, remember, you remember, shot.
And the wife.
Blown in half, and then tried in state court and got, I think, involuntary manslaughter against the sheriff. And then we advocated strongly for him along with Ruben Sandoval. We were involved in that from an advocacy point of view. Didn't do the litigation, I don't think, for the Morales family. But I think we were more active on that in the early 70s and mid 70s, and I don't think we have been as active in later years.
Would you say that in the area of voting rights and in the area of civil rights and abuse of authority, that while at one time the Department of Justice joined the plaintiffs, now the Department of Justice joins the defendants?
Well, that certainly happened during the 80s and early 90s. I think there had been some change under the recent administration where they're not with the defendants as much. But I mean, I personally had that happen in my attesting case I told you about in 19, uh, 1985, we had this old case, United States versus Texas, where we intervened on behalf of GI Foreman Lulac, and we were pursuing that on the testing case. And the Justice Department turned around and was against us. They were the original plaintiffs. We were the plaintiff interveners. The plaintiffs then basically said there's no jurisdiction to hear the case. So, and on desegregation cases, they often change sides between 1981 and 1992. You know, in desegregation cases where they had brought them and then they said, well, there's nothing wrong in this district, we back out. So there certainly was a change there. I think since 1993, there have been some change. I mean, they haven't been as actively in opposition to us. I mean, I was involved in the Fifth Circuit argument in the Austin desegregation case where Bradford Reynolds, representing the Department of Justice, was on the side of the district. It was originally, it was US v. Texas Austin ISD. And the US had been the major proponent of that case, the advocate for the plaintiffs of the United States in that case, but for the minority kids, and just completely changed position for the Fifth Circuit. So it was an amazing process to see.
Before I forget, because I'm getting tired.
Okay. Would you like a Coke or a cup of coffee or something?
No, let me plow okay. through this.
Okay.
On the education fund side of MALDEF, do you all still have leadership training programs? Do you give scholarships to go to law school? Do you pay for bar exam fees?
We still have scholarships for law school. I think they're fairly limited, something like maybe $20,000 a year. I don't think it's very large. But we do have scholarships for law schools.
$20,000 a year?
I think that's right. It might be more, but it's
total,
not.
Total fund or per student?
I think it's total fund per year, but I'm not sure. I'll have to find that out.
That's a pittance.
That's all the funds we can get for it. I mean, you know,
Well, is the staff allocated? Someone allocated to read
money? There's someone allocated to read the applications and to make the scholarship.
No, I mean, to raise money. It seems to me that.
Oh, sure. Leadership. I mean, our fundraiser are always looking for money for that. But the fact is, there are people offering scholarships on their. 100 organizations out there trying to get money to offer scholarships, and we have a fund for it, but it's not very big, so there's not much money in it. I don't know what the amount is, so $20,000. Don't hold me to that. To find that out, right? I can find it out, but I don't think it's a great deal of money. Is what I'm saying.
Well, who's on the board of MALDEF now, and how do they get there?
There's 40 people on the board. It's a national board.
Just give me the list.
I'll give you the list.
40 people. How can there be any accountability?
Well, it's 40 people, all I can tell you. And but remember, they come from California, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas.
This is not a board of directors. That's a shareholders meeting.
Well, there's your executive committee, of course, which I guess has a great deal of the power. But it's a large board. No doubt about that. Almost all of the civil rights organizations, though, do have large boards. I mean, I don't think there are any that have like a board of 5 or 10. I mean, I think they all have large boards, partially for fundraising purposes, of course, because you want a large board membership so they have contacts and can raise money for you. I have no doubt about that. As well as, you know, everybody wants to be represented on the board. So, I mean, if you just had 5, where would they come from? Would you have one from Texas, one from California, one from New Mexico, one from Arizona, one from Colorado? Texas, that'd be terribly unfair to Texas and to California, considering the population. So I think it has to be a large board. 40 is a large board, I agree.
That even suggests that there could even be some potential conflicts of interest of suing certain companies and certain corporate interests or business interests that may be on the board.
Well, we have a policy that we will sue anyone.
Didn't that come up here in San Antonio with Bell Telephone? Where?
Not us. I don't think so.
Southwestern Bell hired Wilmot?
Oh, no. The opposite way.
All right. Well, what's
Wilmot? Wilmot had been the public utility counsel for the state of Texas and had filed a lawsuit against Southwestern Bell. Then we hired Wilmot as head of the office. Southwestern Bell threatened to cut off funding. Wilmot stayed, nothing changed, and Southwestern Bell still giving us money.
Well, so it does come up.
Of course it comes up. I mean, no doubt about that. I mean, anybody who gives you money can bring that up, but we have never not sued someone because of it, and we have never backed off because of it. But, I mean, I'm not saying nobody ever, I mean, they did say something about it.
What kind of percentages or what kind of breakdown can you guesstimate of revenue comes back to Maldet from attorney's fees and the work that you do?
It varies from year to year. I think it's average 10 to 20%. But that's a real important part of the budget. Just because, I mean, the foundation monies are fairly consistent and secure. The contribution monies are fairly consistent, but the attorney's fees, sometimes we make $100,000 for a year, and sometimes we make $2 million in a year. So it just varies. I mean, like on some cases, we've made hundreds and hundreds of thousands. In other cases, we've worked on them, as I said, this higher ed case. You know, we potentially deserve about $2 million in fees. But we so far haven't got a penny, so we're going to see.
Do the regional offices keep those monies in their
fund? All the money we get goes into the general fund, including all the money we get nationally, and then it's distributed to the various offices that train. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, again, not like, unlike most national organizations where you don't really have, you know, the regional offices are not autonomous. We don't have to go out and raise the money, but then we don't get all the money we raise. But then, you know, there's actually probably more money that comes from California and the East Coast than comes from Texas.
From what I recall, the conception of MALDEF had to do with being the legal arm of the Chicano movement at the time, mm-hmm. Chicano Civil Rights Movement. That now has evolved into many other branches that perhaps may not have anything to do with the Chicano movement or civil rights. Can you give us a thumbnail, a sketch of evolution as you see it? Has MALDEF gone through certain stages, or
well,
have you yourself?
I think that all of it has to do with representing the Chicano movement. I really do. I think that there's been an expansion of some of the programs. I mean, it was just a small group of lawyers who went out and filed cases, and that was it. And did a very good job, no doubt about it. Started in Texas. For some of the first cases were against local school districts, New Braunfels, Uvalde. Some in Portales, New Mexico, so, you know, those sorts of cases at first. But we're also involved in advocacy. And by that, I mean, we go to Austin, we go to Sacramento, we go to Washington. And I think are a very effective arm for our Chicanos in those areas, no doubt about that. To a great extent, because we've done the lawsuits. I mean, it's always related. I mean, you know, when I've gone to Austin to talk about school finance, it's not just because I work at MALDEF, it's because MALDEF did the school finance case that makes our voice a particularly important one. Higher ed, when we go talk about higher ed, you know, we also sued the state on higher ed, we were part of the Texas plan, and so we know a lot about it, and we've sued them, so it's related. But we expanded into advocacy more than we ever have before, no doubt about that. There's more leadership programs. You asked earlier about leadership. We have an expanding leadership program. There's like three of them. One of them is parent leadership. We've had a program here in San Antonio for 5 years. We're going to schools and try to teach parents about their rights in school, what you can expect from the school, what the school should do for you, and then we teach them how to go before board meetings, raise hell at the board meetings, get changes in the school, how to work with your teacher, work with the principal. I think it's a wonderful program. It's not large enough at all, but it's a good program. Then we have what they call mid-career leadership and early career. Basically, one of them is basically Chicanos are just starting into a career and want to know more about how the system works. So we have these classes where we teach them about, here's how city government works, county government works, here's how businesses work, here's how to make changes, that sort of thing. And then we have the advanced one where we take what they call mid-career, people who've been out for 10 or 20 years who want to get on boards and commissions, and we train them about, you know, what boards do, commissions do, and all that. Run for city council. We had some real good graduates of that. We had Juanito Solis. Juan Solis is running for state rep, ran for Congress, was a graduate of our program, and a lot of good people here in the community, you know, teachers, community organizers, lawyers, doctors, have all been in our leadership program. We have 5 years of the mid-career leadership here in San Antonio, 5 years of the parent. So we've expanded into the leadership program. So I think those are expansions, but I think they're very valuable. Yeah, I really do. So I don't think there's been anything. I mean, we haven't gone into real estate. We haven't gone into building businesses or anything like that. But I think all of it's still closely aligned with what I really do. I mean, the advocacy stuff. The fact is, you know, we have lawyers with expertise on a payroll who can go work for free in Austin. And if you had people have to pay for that, they could never afford it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I could charge out all my hours over there to groups, we could make a fortune. Or if I could charge one half or one quarter of the fees those lobbyists over there charge, you know, we'd be rich people over here.
Are you doing any work on the NAFTA treaty?
We're part of a coalition that criticized the NAFTA treaty and I think led to the NAD Bank and to the re-education proposals and the environmental concerns. I don't think any of those have been particularly successful yet. But I mean, with Southwest Voter, we're part of that coalition that said we're very concerned about the effect of NAFTA on the community. But we did not take a very strong anti-NAFTA or pro-NAFTA stand. It was pretty much saying that we are against it unless you have, you know, environmental protections, worker protections, and other protections.
I meant in terms of litigation, because the treaty called for retraining of workers that were displaced.
No, we haven't contacted about it. And it's one of those cases I would like to do, where I know in El Paso there's a very serious situation where the retraining programs are very weak. They basically are English language programs rather than retraining and employment programs. And I think there may be some ways to get about it, but we just haven't pulled those together. We have been contacted about it and not done it yet. I'd like to, but just have not done it.
Now, this not done it yet, does that go back to what you said earlier about just barely getting back up the strength and limited resources? Or
part of, sure. I mean,
NAFTA
just,
is not yesterday.
NAFTA's not yesterday. Some of the effects of, you know, these programs that were put in to ameliorate the effects of NAFTA are just beginning to be seen as far as their real effects are concerned. So that is new. But in terms of what you said, let me just say we have just a long list of things we're already involved in. And to some extent, we have to wait till we have some time to do things before we get into a new one. I mean, Edgewood basically, my personal time occupied so much of it in higher ed. Slowly but surely, that's ending. I'm spending more time on testing now. You know, the redistrictings in the early 1990s took the office 4 or 5 years to work through. So now we can do more of individual small districts and school district cases, individual city cases, more than we could back in the early 90s. So, but there's a, you know, we have a long backlog of work. I mean, you know, like just today we've covered about 20 things we probably should be doing. I mean, I probably should spend more time on bilingual education enforcement in Texas, but you know, no doubt about it. There are a lot of things we should be doing we're not doing, but we just...
Well, let me ask you, without being offensive, is part of the understaffing...
It's a fair interchange.
Is part of the understaffing putting an unfair burden on you that you're the only one with any experience and expertise to make decisions on the criteria? Rookie attorneys think every case is great.
Well, rookie attorneys think every case is great, and to some extent I have to say, but I... You know, my rookie attorneys are very interested in doing a lot of things, and they have good judgment. So, but it puts pressure on me to some extent, being the only real experienced lawyer in the office. But you know, I knew that's what I was going to do if I got this job. And on the other hand, you know, it's so important for those of us who like the people on both sides of this camera who've been in the business a long time to teach the young ones. You know, to tell them whatever skills we have, to teach them about the history of this movement, to teach them the skills that they need to get them the community context. I feel very good about that. And on the other hand, I've seen lawyers who've been in practice 20 years who are not as good of lawyers as my new ones over here, because they don't have the energy or the ability or the knowledge about the recent law. And they have the experience, but they sometimes don't have the energy. So I don't feel bad about that. It's good.
In the area of leadership, has Maldiv ever considered the training of potential candidates for judicial posts or providing judges in positions more training and experience so that they can move up into appellate courts? Or does Maldiv have a list of potential nominees for the first Hispanic Supreme Court justice? Those kinds of things. It seems like the training is needed in all those areas, but in the main area of the people that...
Well, at the judicial level, no, we haven't. We have not, you know, we really haven't said that, you know, we have a course for judges to...
Would that be a conflict?
No, I don't think it'd be a conflict. I think it'd be sort of fun. But I mean, also, I'm not sure, you know, at that level it would be very well received. I mean, you know, these judges, most of the judges have been in practice as long as any of us and probably know the law and politics better than we do. I mean, I'm not sure I'm not sure how well we're really needed.
If that was the case, they'd be saying in our favor all the time.
Well, they think they know the law as well as we do. Is the other question, you said, yes, we do have a list of people that we supported for the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, I don't have that list, but I know that there's been a list of names we've suggested for U.S. Supreme Court. One of them was a man who was on the California Supreme Court for many years.
Cruz Reynoso.
Yeah, Cruz Reynoso. I know there's one name on there. There's another. There's a list of several people that we have recommended. There's a lot of issues around, a lot of coalition building with the other Latino organizations, because, I mean, to some extent, people feel that eventually there's going to be a Latino Supreme Court judge. And I think the difficulty is, I don't think we want to get in a situation where, you know, Maldives says it's got to be a Mexican-American judge, and the Puerto Ricans say it's got to be a Puerto Rican judge, and the Cubans say it's got to be a Cuban judge. So there's some coalition building around it, but I don't think we've come up with a short list that everyone agrees on yet. The Hispanic National Bar Association is working on some of that too. But I don't know. I hope we're working on that. And I know we have a list of people that we have supported, and that we've said these are people who, without being an exclusive list, there are people that we think would be good judges. I said, I know Cruz Reynoso's name is on that list. I'm not sure of the other names on the list.
How about a little lower? Is Maldiv interested in nominations of people to
sure.
circuits?
Sure, and we have an office in Washington. And a woman named Gina Verdugo is head of our Washington office, and she is involved watching all of the appointments to the district court, U.S. district court benches, U.S. Fifth Circuit, other circuit appointments, and works with, you know, other civil rights groups around there to sort of look at all the candidates, recommend candidates, and whatever. So we have been involved in that at the Washington level.
Hilda Tagle, Corpus Christi, nominated.
I saw her yesterday.
It's been 3 years.
I saw her.
What's going wrong?
Well, all of these nominations have been held up. I mean, almost all of the nominees by Clinton. After, you know, there were a lot of them that got through the first year in 93, like Judge Garcia here. Orlando Garcia Fred Beery got appointed to the federal bench here in 1993, very quickly nominated and put on. And starting in 94, 95, of course, when the Congress changed, they've just held them up. And even U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Rehnquist has criticized the Congress, and to some extent the administration, mainly the Congress, for holding up those nominations. So Hilda Tagle should definitely be moved through. I mean, there's Jorge Rangel is waiting to get on the Fifth Circuit. There's a judge in Houston, I think one in Dallas, African-American judge in Dallas, who's been held up just as many years. I mean, it's a terrible situation. But we have been working on that, trying to get the administration to move more, of course, getting the Judiciary Committee to move more. But, you know, our power in the Judiciary Committee is not great, I guess, but we're trying. So Maldives, an organization, has been very active on those issues. I mean, to some extent, when I'm answering your questions, I'm answering more from my own experience and this office's experience, but nationally, we've been very involved in those issues, yes.
Well, no, I understand, and I'm sure the reader of this will know that you're not speaking for Maldives in general, but just your role here in San Antonio. But it's, I guess it's typical, no, of what goes on in every other office. No?
Sure, the regional offices, yeah. I mean, our office, there's Chicago, San Francisco. Those three offices act very much the same in terms of about the same staff and, you know, the same general interaction. Now, there's a Los Angeles regional office, which, of course, is, you know, in the same building as the national office, so they have a little bit closer contact with the national office. And then the Washington office does all advocacy work, so they're not doing litigation.
Is anyone there registered as a lobbyist?
Yes, I think all three of them are. Okay. Yeah.
How does the left hand know what the right hand is doing within Mulder?
Well, the communication is probably better than it used to be. There's we have monthly conference calls of the heads of all the offices. We send in reports every quarter on everything we're doing. We have, as I say, conference calls by phone. We have a yearly staff meeting where all the staff, all of the legal staff gets together and talks about where the cases are going, what we're doing, what we're going to do next. All of our litigation has to be approved by the Vice President of Litigation, who is not going to let us have one case here arguing that bilingual education is required by a certain law and have another case somewhere that says it's not required by that law. So, I mean, we've got that sort of controls. But it's always, I mean, it's always a tension there between, you know, coordination versus too much control. I mean, all the regional offices want to set their own agendas, want to do their own things. And of course, people in national office want to make sure they know exactly what's going on and want to make sure that everything's consistent. So the right hand knows what the left hand's doing.
Does Antonio call you regional officers for the periodic meetings, quarterly, monthly, regular, or do they by phone?
Well, Antonio calls us sort of whenever she wants from time to time. We meet with the vice president. The vice president of litigation named Teresa Fe Bustillos is the vice president. And she talks to us every month as a group, all the heads of all the offices. Every month talk about what's going on, what are the issues, you know, here's what we're doing, here's what we're doing there. We all talk to each other then. And in addition, she calls up, you know, at least once a week to find out everything that's going on. So I think there's pretty good communication, actually.
What was the story behind that meeting when there was a candidate for Antonia's position when she was still sitting as the president, Doña Naya? What was all that about?
Well, I was lucky. I was at a low enough level there, so I don't really know what's going on. So I know that it happened in the mid 80s, and I think there was, I basically think that there was a group of board members who felt that they wanted another leader for the organization, and they were about to go ahead and hire that person. I think maybe it was Tony, I don't know who it was, and had planned to remove Antonia and hire their own person. And so there was a power struggle on the board, but I think, you know, it didn't happen. So and there's no change in leadership there, but there was certainly a power struggle about that.
What do you know about what MALDEF did or the Washington office did or anyone else did here when Norma Cantu wrote that wonderful letter opposing the Attorney General Morales' decision that mm-hmm. Hopwood applied to everyone? And she said, you're going to lose federal funds. And within a week, the rug is pulled out from Norma. Mm-hmm. What did MALDEF or anybody else do about that?
We wrote a very strong letter to Janet Reno saying we strongly disagree with the actions taken by the Solicitor General there. We wrote a letter to the President saying we disagree with what was done. We wrote a letter to the Secretary of Education saying that he should have supported Norma all the way through and literally not in effect forced her to back off some of those positions. So I mean, we did whatever advocacy we could. We wrote those letters, we made the calls. I mean, we did not do marches in the street, and we didn't do that sort of action. But we took actions we felt were appropriate, which is writing letters, as I said, to the President, to the Secretary of Education, to the Attorney General, strongly supporting Norma.
And what happened?
Basically they said we did what we did. I mean, it didn't change.
Why did Mueller not attack Morales on his Hopwood?
I think we attacked him very strongly. I wrote several letters to the editor that were published all over the state. I think that Barbara Aldave and I were seen as the strongest critics in the entire state against Morales. I met with the House Mexican American Caucus, with the Senate Hispanic Caucus. I wrote articles strongly criticizing him. We issued press releases strongly criticizing him. I think we were probably the leaders in the state to criticize him for that decision, absolutely. I testified before the House Committee and the Senate Education Committee saying he was wrong in his decision and that his interpretation of Hopwood was wrong. You bet. I think we're very active on that.
Well, couldn't that be litigated? That's just an opinion.
Just an opinion.
The universities went way beyond in the implementation.
Absolutely, and it could be litigated. And I'll just tell you that I've, it's on the list of things to do. I basically have everything I need to do to litigate it. It's just a matter of waiting for the right case at the right time with the right facts. I mean, if you notice what happened, you know, the universities did fairly well. It's only the law schools, the UT law school is the only one, and the medical schools that really did badly. I mean, by badly, I think all of them have done badly, historically, no doubt about that. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is as far as getting worse, you know, we were originally afraid that UT Austin would go down from 11% to 5% Mexican American entering class. It didn't. It stayed at the same percentage. So did A&M. University of Houston Law School stayed at the same percentage. UT Law School went down dramatically. And they're probably the ones who need to be sued. The medical schools all went down, about 20-30%.
Quick questions to conclude here. Who is the most effective Mexican American leader today?
Until 2 weeks ago, I would have said Henry Cisneros. Now I'm not sure. I think it might be between Izaguirre and Antonio. As far as when I say leader, I'm talking about leader on issues that are of great importance to me. I mean, I guess if you look past that, you know, to some extent, Morales has affected a lot of policies. I mean, I don't think Dan Morales I'm talking about. But I would say those two, as far as the national civil rights scene is concerned, I think those two would probably be in the top two for sure.
What's the most effective Mexican-American organization?
Well, in law, it's us. I really think that. I think in law, nationally, it's Maldiv. As far as general advocacy, I think it's somewhere between the National Council and Maldiv.
What are the most pressing issues facing the Mexican-American community today?
Well, I mean, there's a whole list. I mean, there's employment, there's education come first to mind.
Okay, well then rank.
What's
number one, what's number two, what's number three?
I really think it's education first. And I'd probably put employment next and voting rights next, although it's very hard to rank them. I mean, people can argue that forever. I really feel that if we get enough of our people in and out of high school, in and out of college, that the employment and the voting stuff will come along. I really do. But I think the education stuff, trying to get more of our people into good colleges, out of good colleges, into graduate professional schools, out of them, is just so important. Because I think once we get that, a lot of the other stuff will come along. And of course, also getting a good quality high school education so you can go out and get a good quality job. You know, they're all interrelated, I know that. I mean, if we had better voting, we'd probably have better school districts, and we'd have better educated kids. If we had better employment, we'd probably have more voting and elect more of our own people, and we'd have better schools. And if we had better employment, we could send our kids to better schools and finance. I mean, all of it's related. I mean, so asking me to rank them, as you know, is an impossible task. But I think if we had more of our kids getting into and out of good colleges, grad schools, that would be probably the quickest way to move on up. I really do.
What do you think are the underpinnings of tension between browns and blacks?
Well, we've been forced into a system where we're fighting over the bones. You know, they say, you know, we're fighting over the huesitos, you know, the little bones. You know, there's very little money available for poverty programs, for civil rights programs, and to some extent, the people who have the power said, you know, we're paid at the office. This is how much we will pay. You guys work it out. And so we've been forced into fighting it out. And I think that's been very difficult. The way the law goes in terms of redistricting, in terms of employment, you know, often if one group gets a major victory, it sometimes does hurt the other group. So I think that there are tensions, and I think we do need to do a lot of talking with each other. I think the common areas are much greater than the ones with difference. I mean, like, we work real closely with the state in NAACP. I cannot think of any issue where we disagreed with them. Gary Bledsoe, personal friend of ours, worked very closely with him. But in some of the redistricting issues, it's going to be pretty sensitive, especially in the year 2001, where you can no longer, at least officially, draw districts according to race, using race as the criteria. And if you don't, if you try to come up with square districts or rectangular districts with no curvy lines, you know, there's just no way you're going to be able to have districts that are good for Mexican Americans and good for blacks.
What ought to be the relations between Chicanos and persons of Mexican ancestry in Mexico and Mexico to them?
I guess they ought to be very, very close, because I mean, you know, we just, you know, share the same blood, and I think the only difference is, of course, that the Mexicans in Mexico, their struggles are almost all poor versus rich. Native Americans versus you know, the hueros in the country, and more than, you know, white against black against Mexican American as it is here in the United States. But I think there's a lot of commonality, and I think we can make a lot of progress working together. I really do.
Taking the last question.
Sure.
In the context of leadership for the Mexican American community, how do you characterize the role of Maldiv?
Mainly, I think, is a very strong legal voice taking the strong positions on major legal issues like school finance, bilingual education, voting rights, immigration rights. I see that as sort of the voice of the lawyers that are most closely related to the community. That's where I see it as the strongest role.
Last question. Is there something that I have, in this segment at least, forgotten to ask you that you think I should have asked and you should say something about or rephrase something or add something?
Well, you know, as I said, you are going to try to get that other tape where we develop the educational stuff. MALDEF's work in education went through some phases, and I think that is important. We started out doing desegregation work. Basically, Mexicans were part of separate schools. That was in the late 60s, early 70s. In the late 70s, it was more an issue of getting involved in the desegregation cases, but making sure we've got good programs out of them, rather than just, you know, desegregating schools by numbers, making sure there was a mixture of kids in the schools. It was more, the blacks were moving for that more. We were moving for more teachers, more bilingual programs, dropout programs, that sort of thing. So I think there was a different approach.
And then you moved to finance.
And then we moved more into finance, affirmative action in higher ed and higher ed work, sort of the early 80s through the mid 80s. And now I think it's involved in testing. Also, though, affirmative action is very strong. Affirmative action education is a major project. And of course, we're still following up on some of these old desegregation cases. And you said about the ones we haven't followed up on, there are some, obviously. Next week, though, we're going to El Paso to follow up on that one and going to Odessa to follow up on that one. So we're trying to do some of that.
Is Tucson out of this office? Or who,
Tucson
who
is out of Los Angeles.
Out of Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Okay. Because that's another brewing segregation case. Anything else?
I think that's it.
Albert, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. And listen, I don't mind, I think...